making some sociological points before engaging the particular empirical. And one very general point has to do with the relationship between words and concepts. So the word middle class has become a common way of talking in a very broad range of countries. They talk about it in China, they talk about it in South Africa, the United States, Poland, Ukraine. It's become part of the ordinary language of talking about something, the ordinary discourse. It's also tied up with a technical term that's used in theoretical discussions in sociology. It means something very specific. Now, words have this flexible character, and there are, I think, increasingly sociologists who just take the common language word and deploy it in their sociology, forgetting the important standing that this concept has within a range of sociological traditions. This causes endless confusion. Now, I have no objections whatsoever to the ordinary language use of class. It's kind of absurd to object to the use of a word in ordinary language. That's what people do. They use words. And they mean something. And it's important for us as analysts to understand what people mean when they talk in their ordinary language. What I am regretting is the confusion it generates within social theory, where a crucial idea ends up getting deflected because of the mushiness of the everyday language. That's just a kind of grand comment about words and concepts. So first, let me say something about the word as it's used in everyday language, and then something about the concept as it's used in sociology. And then we can see whether or not we actually can connect these in a convincing way. I think in everyday language, it means ordinary people. It just means people who are not powerful and elite, and they're not marketable. So it's a contrast to two kinds of extremes in a social structure. On the one hand, the excluded, people who are on the margins, who don't have stable positions in the society. And on the other hand, oligarchs, elites, powerful actors, who are disengaged and in a certain sense are also marginal to the society, marginalized. One of the characteristics, I think, of the current elite structures that unite in an ironic way, perhaps, Russia, Ukraine, and the United States, is that they all don't care about their own countries. They just don't care. I mean, the American wealthy elite are global actors whose interests are only thinly tied to the well-being of the country in which they're nominally located. This is an old standing issue in places like Brazil, where you have gated communities with private bodyguards to protect a little private state around every very rich person, to protect them from their society. So they don't care about the society. It doesn't matter. Their well-being, their prospects, their children's prospects do not depend upon the well-being of the country where they happen to be based. And in that sense, the elite is also marginalized from the mainstream of the society. You know, I don't mean in the sense of excluded. They exclude themselves. And the middle class, I think in most discussions, just means people who aren't one of those two types. It's this very, that's certainly what Obama meant when he talked about helping the middle class. He meant this stable core of just ordinary people who live in a country and whose lives depend upon how well that country does. And not people who are excluded, so the purpose is to include those people also in the middle class. And it really, the slogan of the Occupy movement, we are the 99%, you know, it's a little exaggerated. I don't know if this top elite is 1%, maybe it's 0.5%. It has allies that are probably top 10%. But it does really capture what's going on. Now, from a sociological point of view, it's kind of crazy to say that 99% of the population is middle class. I mean,
middle schmittel. It's just not a sociologically useful idea. But it's a very powerful bit of contemporary discourse, this notion of everybody wanting to be in the middle class. That means they don't want to be excluded. Now, it may be in the movements you study that the people who are going to go out and protest and engage and occupy in these other movements, they're typically young. Protesters are always typically young. Conservative populist right-wingers tend to be a bit older often. But, you know, mostly protesters are young. They have the time and energy for doing that sort of thing. Partially what looks like that they're particularly educated comes from the demography of the age structure of education. I mean, it is that they're perhaps they're more cosmopolitan, more educated in that way. A lot of it, I think, is that they're young. It doesn't mean that we should therefore identify the concept of the middle class that's being used in political discourses with the people who are protesting. Because the political discourses is a much broader notion of people who aren't on these margins, top margin or bottom margin. Okay, that's the popular discourse. Let me just say something about the sociological concept. So in sociology, the idea of the middle class is very deeply anchored in what the term class... let me step back. The key thing is that the term class is deeply anchored in sociological theory. And the adjectives we apply to class depend upon the nature of the theory of class that we're using. Now, I find the most useful traditions of sociological traditions of class analysis are those which understand class as a social relation rather than as an attribute of persons. That's a pretty tough thing to really get your head around. What does it mean to say it's a social relation rather than an attribute of persons? This is easy to understand in... particularly in the Marxist tradition, but also the Weberian tradition, which actually tracks Marx pretty closely. Sociology courses typically say Marx versus Weber. It's really not the right way to think about it. Weber is a kind of abbreviated Marx. He's sort of half of Marx. He left off half of the story. And early, for those of you who are sociologists, if you read really early Weber, this is the writings by Weber before, so to speak, he became Weber. That is, this is the writings before he had his mental breakdown in the late 1890s. He was out of commission for 4 or 5 years with severe depression. And it was, you know, his colleagues and friends were concerned that he would never get back on track. He has these interesting writings before that. And all the things we read are the stuff he wrote after he got his mental state back together. In his early writings, there's a fantastic set of publications came out of his dissertation, which I've periodically given to graduate students, PhD students, to read without attribution. It's about basically slavery in the Roman Empire and the collapse of the Roman Empire. I asked them to read this, and I said, this is written towards the end of the 19th century. Tell me something about the author. Who could have written this? And they all think it was written by some young hotshot Marxist who was just trying to refurbish the Marxist concept of class. That's how it sounds. Okay, that was a digression. I'm giving you kind of stream of consciousness here as points come. So come to mind. All right, I'm going on too long. This is just too much fun, you know. I have a captive audience. I get to talk about interesting things. The key thing, I think, in the sociological traditions in which class really matters is that it's a relational idea. The clearest example would be in some pre-capitalist societies, in slavery. You cannot define the category slave without defining the category slave owner. There's no such thing as a slave defined just by their attributes. they have to be defined by their relationship to another social category. And the same is true for capitalism. You can't define the category worker within a relational concept without defining the category capitalist. They are defined by their respective relationship to each other. So in a sense, the relation is prior to the position, or the positions are defined within relations. That is the fundamental property of most systematic class analysis. It's true in Weber as well. Weber's account of the relations that define classes, I think, is thinner, less interesting than the Marxian account. It doesn't have the same kind of fully developed analysis. On the other hand, we rely pretty much on a few scattered paragraphs of an incomplete manuscript from Weber to get his formal definitions, because he never really got around to giving us his systematic account. And I suspect if he had, it would look even more Marxian than it ends up even in the current texts. So the key idea is it's relational. And the substance, the stuff of these relations is power. Power is the real stuff of class relations. Class relations are social relations that organize the distribution of power over economic processes. And above all, but not only, that means power over the deployment of resources within the economy. That's why Marxian definitions always say classes are defined by relationship to the means of production. That's a kind of shorthand for classes are defined by the social relations that give people access to and exclusion from control over resources. It's a power-based concept where power, the power in question, is power deployed over resources. Different kinds of class systems, therefore, allow different kinds of resources to be the subjects of power. So in slavery, you're allowed to own people. In capitalism, you're not. So slavery is also power relations with respect to economic resources. It's just the inventory of ownable resources is different from capitalism. And a lot hinges on that. Because once you can't own people, then the owners of other resources have this big problem. How do you get people to work if you don't own them? Well, you've got to bribe them. That is, you pay them wages. And you need a set of institutions called contracts and labor markets in order to connect people to the resources that you want to be deployed. If the middle class then is defined as everybody who isn't on the margins, it's very hard for that to have a relational character. It's just ordinary people, right? But what does the middle class mean if you do have a relational category? Now, we think relations have this quality that they seem binary, right? The classic language, lord and serf, slave owner and slave, capitalist and worker, that seems like a very simple binary kind of class structure where there's really only two sorts of positions. Well, this is where the bulk of my work on class analysis has come from. It's trying to understand how we can have a power-centered relational concept of class that isn't binary. And it basically involves understanding, decomposing these relations and understanding that they are actually multidimensional and that they create a variety of positions within a class structure in which, in certain respects, people have power and control over resources, and in other respects, they are subordinated to others who have power. And the middle class are basically these contradictory positions within power relations over production. They're people that are both controllers and controlled, if you want a kind of simple formula. That's a very different set of ideas from the ones, you know, that you were talking about. But I don't think there's... I think that's a... It's only a tension of words. It's not a tension of reality. It's an interesting fact that political mobilizations at this point in history are directed at defining a broad population in opposition to an elite on the one hand and different from an excluded group on the other. But that's the way identities are formed and coalitions are built and a sense of who we are in our interests are created. even though those people live in a world where they get subordinated in different ways within what I'm calling class relations. All right, that was more than 5 minutes, but it's at least an initial commentary on the discursive space in which we're playing.
Thank you very much. Nastya and... Nastya?
Yeah, I could add a little bit to what Eric was saying about the different ways of talking about class. And for me, I think that talking about middle class in Central and Eastern Europe, at least... but also in other places, I know there are big debates about this in the UK, is a way to avoid talking about class and class relations, is to move the discussion to different registers, to move the discussion, for example, to lifestyle choices and different practices and identities, and to move the discussion to culture, for example, how certain people differ in their ordinary life. Or just to talk about stratification, kind of very generally. There are some people who are lower than others, there are some people in the middle, and some people who are higher than others. It's not necessarily that people in the middle are the majority. Actually, some sociologists would be talking about, like in Ukraine, we have a problem that our middle class is not big enough. It should be the majority in a normal country, because we want a country that's stable, where the middle class is happy, satisfied, educated, engaged in social life, active in different NGOs and stuff. So there's various criteria of a lifestyle of the middle class, and we want this lifestyle to be like the dominant in our society. We treasure those kinds of people. We want to have more of those people. But many sociologists would say that unfortunately the middle class in Ukraine is not the majority. Unfortunately, the lower class is very big. So it's not always that the middle class is the majority, but it's a way of talking about people on a certain ladder. So some people are in the middle, some people are below them, and some people are above them. So just a system of stratification, it's not really about class. It's just about placing people on this ladder. And it's also a way to avoid talking about social relations, because then if you start talking about where does the working class fit in this perspective, then you end up either having to admit that the working class is, if it's the majority, and then the working class is part of the middle class in this framework, or you have to exclude the working class as well and say, well, yeah, the working class isn't really the middle class for us, because they don't really have the same kind of values that we see in the middle class. And that's what a lot of the debates in sociology in the UK are about. So they would be talking about middle class versus working class and the different values. And in the post-Soviet countries as well, you would have some discussions where the workers are more paternalist, they're more pro-Soviet, they want the Soviet Union to return, they want more stability, they don't like this unpredictable social context where you have to adapt constantly, where you have to be more flexible. They want to have a job for life that is well paid, and the state guarantees them everything. Whereas the middle class is more creative, more mobile, more willing to change things in their life, to take risk, more flexible, and so on. So in this way, basically, You have this distinction between the working class and the middle class that is political, and it's also very ideological. So it's about the word, it's not about the sociological concept, it's about how we talk about the middle class versus the working class. And I see a big problem here of in this way of distinguishing between working class and middle class. And we did this research with my students about a Bolshevik plant and shopping center in Kiev. So those who are from Kiev probably know about the plant. And it's one of the oldest and the biggest machine building plants in Ukraine. And it was founded before the October Revolution. But in the Soviet Union, it was also a very big and powerful plant. And after the collapse of the Soviet Union, it started falling apart. There's the number of workers decreased by 10 times. And most of the buildings were sold off. And a big shopping center was created there. And some of the workers are still there, maybe about 1,000 workers. They only work 3 days a week. They know that the plant is doomed. So there's this kind of idea of things falling apart, the plant and all everything related to it belonging to the past. Very often these are the older workers who just hope that they will survive until retirement age. Many of the other workers now went to work at the shopping center. The students had to do interviews with the current and former workers at that plant and their family members and just visit the site. What's interesting is that most students coming from middle class background, if we talk that way, they didn't know where the plant was located. And it's not that they've never been in the area. It's not that they're not from Kiev. The plant is quite centrally located near the exit of Shulavska metro station. So everybody who's been to Shulavska metro station they had to see the plant. Like, you could not just not see it. It's very big, it's very visible. But because it doesn't constitute part of their everyday experiences, it's like it's not on their mental map. They could be passing it every day but not noticing it. It's not something that it's not the kind of experience they know about or they engage with daily. But everybody knew where the shopping center was, and they're just right, like, next door to each other. So it shows a lot about ideology and about urban space as well and about class structure. So that case was interesting for us with the students because you could see these changes in class structure and in ways of talking about class and changes in ideology and changes in urban space occurring simultaneously. So you have this ideological binary opposition where you have communism versus capitalism, you have working class versus middle class, you have production versus consumption. So a good Soviet city was a city of production. You would have postcards with plants there, greetings from Kiev with the Arsenal plant, for example, or Bolshevik plant. And a good capitalist city is a city of consumption where you have many shopping malls, cafes, and so on. Then you have in this binary opposition, you would have like left column, the right column. You'd have kind of static, and the plant is static, kind of falling apart, not working anymore. And dynamic, capitalism is dynamic. Then you have gray, bright, and colorful, belonging to the past, belonging to the future. So you have a whole set of these binary oppositions where you would also have this distinction between working class, middle class, communism, capitalism, production, consumption, and so on. So I think in Central Eastern Europe, at least, the usage of the word middle class was very ideological, and it stood for, like, we want a certain kind of people with a certain kind of values and a certain kind of people that would support the economic transformations that would be more adaptable in these social conditions, and we want to glorify this kind of people. So it was a lot about values and lifestyles and attitudes, and then we have all these other people who are kind of the dangerous classes, whom we don't really know what to do about them. We don't really know how to write about them and what to make of these workers. So they should either disappear or they should merge into the middle class somehow with time. Maybe they're just in the process of adapting and they'll make it later. So something that I wanted to add is that when we're looking at this, we should also not look at the ideological context where these discussions are taking place and how they're being used by various social agents and why. And then in this sense also, why do people want to belong to the middle classes? Because they don't want to be treated as those Soviet guys who are holding the country back, who are not adapting, who are the losers. Of course they want to be ordinary or with the winners, or at least average. Like in Ukraine, the middle class, середні, means in the middle, but it also means average. So like everybody else. So people want to be identified like everybody else. And I did some research I used the social monitoring questions as a basis, but I did then some in-depth interviews based on them. And there were some questions, where would you classify yourself on the social ladder? And people actually had difficulties identifying themselves there. They would on the one hand, they would be talking about themselves being poor. So they would say, we are poor. If you ask how much do you earn, they would often even say less than what they actually earn. So they would identify themselves on the lower steps. If you ask them about their income or if they're poorer or wealthier than the majority, they would say that they're poor. And that was a political statement they were making. So they think that sociologists have some access to people in power. And they want everybody to, they want to say in this way that we are dissatisfied with our position, with our position in society. We think that we should be living better, like that these living conditions are unsatisfactory. So they identify themselves as poor. On the other hand, when you ask them about middle class, lower class, and upper class, they would say that they are middle class. So they would refuse to be called like the lower class in this sense, and they would say that everybody else is like that. Everybody else is in such conditions. So I think depending on the question you're asking and how the people understand it, like whether they understand it as a political, like identifying themselves as a certain class, that it would have certain political consequences. When I asked another social monitoring question, how satisfied are you with your life? And you have five answers, completely dissatisfied, rather dissatisfied, or difficult to say, rather satisfied and completely satisfied. One of the respondents started saying, well, I don't know what to answer. Like, yeah, on the one hand, I can't really complain. Everything's fine. Thank God there's no war in our country. And we have food on our table. And our child, my granddaughter just started school recently, and she's doing really well, and she's very happy. So she started talking about good things. So I said, okay, am I going to write completely satisfied? No. No one can be completely satisfied. So should I write rather satisfied? Well, no, don't write that. You know, actually, our salaries are very low, and Christmas is approaching, and we have to spend so much money on presents and on Christmas play, and we don't even have my daughter. And recently came that they need the money for the school play, for the children and for the presents, and we don't have that money. So actually, this is bad and this is bad. And the oligarchs are, they start complaining. And I said, should I write rather dissatisfied? Well, I can say rather dissatisfied because I just told you it could be worse. Like, so she has difficulty responding to that question. And I say, should I say difficult to say? And she says, why difficult? It's not difficult. I just told you. And and then I say, but you have to pick something and pick one answer. And she said, okay, if I have to pick, then write the dissatisfied option and tell those people up there. So it's really making, So the thing about class, when we're talking about wars, it is very complicated. It is very politicized, and there's a lot of ideology involved that we have to, as sociologists, probably to look at.
That's also a fantastic illustration of a really deep methodological problem in sociology when you use questionnaires, because a response is a communication. You're not tapping into what's going on in the brain of somebody. You're tapping into what they want to communicate, which is a relation. Communication is always relational. And so that person wasn't communicating actually to you. They were communicating to the oligarchs in their mind. That's who they wanted to hear their answer. And so the whole meaning of the question is different. No, you didn't ask the question, what do you think the oligarch should think about your life? Very dissatisfying. That wasn't the question.
Yeah. But Oksana, what's your position and what's your interest in the topic?
I should begin with a short disclaimer, because I'm not an academic, and my professional identity is journalism. And as a journalist, I was trained to be a watchdog, and that's why I nosed out some irregularities in this world. Yes, some contradictions, and as to the topic, we didn't focus in Critica on the middle class precisely. We covered Occupy Wall Street, of course, and lately we organized several debates on the mission of public intellectuals. So I can tell something about this very small group inside of what we can presume is middle class. Yeah, but for me, the very definition intellectuals or intellectuals or creative people as a part of middle class is questionable. When I moderated these debates, I had to be a sort of devil's advocate, yeah? And I asked them, why, as a person from the street, yeah? Why should I pay you? Why do I need you? Why anyone who write articles, normal person is even struggle to read, should be paid for it. And I can say for now that I didn't get answers in those terms. Of course, I got answers in their own terms, because of course intellectuals are well aware of their mission, of their passion, and of their responsibility. But they know for sure they're good in thinking, and some of them are even agreed to provide solution, to provide idea as an expert. Here, one of our participants agreed that he could be an expert, and an expert is something different from an intellectual. So he described it that way. And of course, I'm talking about very, very small group. And they're all public persons. They're very charismatic and well-known. But I'm sure that all these notions are relevant for the bigger group. For so-called... I don't like these terms of Florida as creative class. I think it's confusing. But a bigger group of people who earn their living with thinking, with writing, with providing ideas, with designing, and that's the question: why on earth anyone should be paid for thinking? Well, everybody think, yeah. I can think, yeah, and now in this current situation, with all these technological changes, anyone can talk to the world. Yeah, I can write my blog, or I can decorate a bowl. Why should I be well paid for it? Yeah, and when everyone can broadcast his or her opinion to the world, he or she understood that it's fun. And why anyone should be paid for having fun? And now I think the main issue here is not the assessment of quality of these ideas or texts and so forth. Because today I was going to talk about fear and guilt. And if we leave aside this assessment, yeah, the question is that actually 50 or even 20 years ago, many people also could provide new ideas or write, but they had to go through this specific filters, yeah, to talk to the world. Now this hierarchy is much more spectral, and this magic of being a writer or being an artist or being an intellectual has gone. Almost everybody seems equal. And of course, you know, this changed from country to country, from institution to institution. And once I surprised the journalist from the Chicago Tribune. We were talking about trade union in a newspaper, and he was surprised by my question. Because he didn't understand why journalists in such a paper should need a trade union. Lawyers or surgeons don't need a trade union. Why journalists need it? And the matter is the most journalists in the world need trade unions more than ever before. Journalist now is a proletarian more than ever before. And my guess is why we still live in this, you know, old patterns of white collars and blue collars framework. The reality is far away from this old perception. What I see that intellectuals still feel guilty, or they are supposed to feel guilty for not doing, you know, manual labor to earn their living. They are supposed to be responsible for the people who do, for these blue collars who are, you know, maybe underprivileged. And at the same time, they already feel vulnerable as knowledge becomes more and more accessible, and broadcasting becomes more and more accessible, and it seems like everyone can produce new sensors. And so comes this fear to become disposable. And it's not just a fear of personal fail. That's a fear to be dissolved as a guild or as a class, as we may say. And one may say that this problem is relevant only for academics, for humanitarians, for artists, yeah? And my professional experience in consulting, multi as charged, is an evidence to the contrary. If your product is just a file, and it doesn't matter how much profit it can bring, it doesn't matter how much blood, sweat, and tears it cost. It doesn't matter how good it is. You have to put some extra effort to prove its value. So this is something that, you know, a plumber doesn't need to do. A truck doesn't need to do, yeah? We, of course, a plumber or a trucker hold, you know, the same risk not to be paid as a consultant. But if a consultant or a customer break a contract, yeah, we all have the same risk, but take the same risk. But you know, if a trucker are not paid, he or she, or maybe she, knows it's unfair. He or she is sure this is unfair. And a consultant is poisoned with doubt in this situation. And one more story, if you don't mind. One also may say that this problem is relevant only for the, you know, oligarchic capitalism. But I can't stop thinking of my parents. In mid-70s, they were engineers in Institute for Applied Physics in Western Ukraine, in Lviv. And approximately once a month, they had been taken to a collective farm. and why all CIA and while all Western world thought that they are busy with, you know, with developing these precise, high precise optics for Soviet military, they were busy with picking up carrot in the fields. And or sometimes they were cleaning up a new built hospital. So they were engineers in military. But still, they had to pay it off for not being a working class in the Soviet Union. And that's a contradiction I'm not comfortable with. And it puts me to take a broad look. What I have voiced above is a shadow of, you know, this larger resentment, especially after the recession of 2008. And the core of this resentment is the idea that as so-called middle class is shrinking, that intellectuals and creative workers are exactly that ballast to get rid of, yeah? So you can shift them to the underclass. And my point here, that's the only solution that I can find for this contradiction. The only thought I can deal with is that these intellectuals, artists, journalists, and creative workers, they enjoy their work. If they like it, if they like enough, they also enjoy some attention, and maybe even some praise. And this dirty little secret is they are presumed to feel guilty for that. So they should pay back for enjoying their work. I think that most of the company included know somebody or maybe been under threat themselves or not threat at all. And in most cases, that happens by default. Like, these people don't really need to be paid. Yeah, they're happy enough. And tell me, how many plumbers do you know who would work for free? And this conflict is a conflict of expectations. Yeah? You know, the creative artists and intellectuals, they are expected to suffer, to live on beans. And, of course, they themselves are expected to be well paid. I will go to the final notion. So my question here is, should a job you enjoy be paid less than a job you hate?
So what a final, what a wonderful question mark at the end. I think this is really interesting approach that you took of what was the, so to say, the public ideology applied to the middle class on both ends of the Atlantic, or most of the time, because the middle class had to suffer guilt for not being the working class here, while in the United States it was a promised land to buy the pleasures of life, being a middle class, and to aspire to for more consumption and enjoy as much as you can not being the working class anymore. Right, I think we are at the best moment to open the discussions and questions from the floor.
If I can make just one comment on this last point, what's really in play in what you're saying is whether the principles of distribution should be based on market power or on some moral principle by which we decide what's the appropriate thing to pay people for different kinds of activities. Now, if a group of people get together to share cooperatively some productive task which they have, a bunch of friends want to build a summer DACA or something together, right? How do they do it? They try to share the burdens and the pleasures of the work equally. So if so, the basic principle is everybody should do their fair share. They should bear the same burdens because they're going to collectively, cooperatively benefit from the joint task. In a market economy, the principle of pay has nothing to do with that, with burdens and benefits. It just is, what's the demand for your service by people who have money and want it? So if you're an artist and you happen to do the kind of art that rich people like, you get paid a fortune. If you're an artist and you don't do the kind of art that rich people like, you live on beans. It has nothing to do with how much fun it is, how much burdensome it is. That's not the basis of pay. The basis of pay is what people are prepared to pay because they want what you can do. Now my feeling is that in an ideal world, if I was to ask what's the moral principle by which I think pay should be distributed, it is definitely that pleasant work should be paid less than burdensome work. People should be compensated for the unpleasantness of work. If it's fun, you should be paid less. You don't need to be compensated because you would do it anyway. Everybody, however, everybody should be paid sufficient to live a flourishing life. So there's a kind of unconditional background condition that everybody should have equal access to the material conditions to live a flourishing life. And then if you want earnings above that, it should be basically a function of what economists call the disutility of labor. You should have to really bribe people to do nasty work and not bribe them very much to do work that's fulfilling. So yes, I think American academics are way overpaid by any moral standard that I could defend. Whereas people who pick strawberries in the fields are grossly underpaid by any moral standard that I can defend. It's not just that academics who love what they do, like I do. The fact of the matter is, if I was independently wealthy and had a comfortable standard of living guaranteed independently of my work, I would do virtually exactly what I'm doing. There's almost nothing I do that I wouldn't do. So I'm not doing what I'm doing because I need to be bribed to do it. That's what I want to do, and fortunately I'd get paid.
Well, I must add a footnote to that, which is depends on where you live and where you come from. Being an academic in this part of the world doesn't bring you as much money as being a plumber. Plumber is much well off. And
by the way, a very large number of plumbers and carpenters aren't paid anything. They do it yourself.
In states,
it's do it yourselfers. People who are doing plumbing and carpentry in their own homes. They're not being paid. They're doing it because they want to, because they're solving a problem.
Yeah. Well, there
In any case, I would open the floor to discussion and to questions, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Still, right? And then, okay. So please raise your hands and introduce yourself and ask your questions, and I'll take several if there are several. If not, we will continue talking until the very late evening. Okay. So questions, comments. Are there any? No?
Well, I have a challenge. This is really going to tax the cultural capacities. I propose that we just sit silently until somebody asks a question. And let's just see how long people can bear it.
I think we're all interested in what Nastya was about to say, and I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No, I was just going to say that with academics, it's not so simple No, either, because there is a very big number of precarious younger academics in the U.S. who don't have tenure yet, and who are struggling to get some kind of job at all. And there is this the part of ideology that, well, you will have some benefits later, or because this job is fulfilling, you should you'd be doing it anyway. Then, or for example, where the PhD students graduate students, they even have to pay to be given an opportunity to teach a course, to get some experience before being able to enter the labor market. So even with academics, it's not such a... And with many jobs that are... in general, this idea of individual responsibility for your success and failure, that it's all about your own capacities and all about your own... qualities, whether how adaptable you are, how flexible you are, that does shift part of the responsibility from your employer. So the employer can always say that, well, you didn't try hard enough. It does lead to changes in the labor market, that this kind of ideology that you were talking about, is, you can see it especially with the... So what the jobs that we call office plankton, or the lower managerial positions, or like when you were working for consultant firms, where there's less security, there's the contracts are only for one specific task, and you don't know how much you're going to get in the end, because it's not like a fixed salary that you'd be getting in a normal according to normal working situation. So there have been ideological changes. So I would agree with that some ideological changes that put a lot of responsibility on you and say that it's all about yourself, your personality, your ability to do things well. It has allowed employers to also neglect some of their responsibilities with regard to labor rights, especially in this non-productive sector, and for the creative class type jobs. But everywhere, in other places too, of course.
I love the discussion, which becomes a little bit about utilitarianism and Jeremy Bentham ideas that live today. What's the principle of happiness, and how should you remunerate based on happiness or not, or is it functional, and what does it serve, what purpose does it serve? Well, I tend to be suspicious to that kind of equations where you exchange happiness for profit, because what you should pay more to a millionaire that suffers and when he earns money, I don't know. But I have one question, a general question that I would like to all of you to try to answer. Who is in the middle class? How would you describe it? People there? I mean, who is in the middle class today? In general, is there an identity question behind that? Or I know you will say it's a second step after you define the relationships. But if you answer this in a popular language and not on the grounds of theory that much, would you say, can you describe today who is in the middle class? You could do that in 50 years ago. No?
Well, in terms of identity, if you're asking people about their identities, most people say they're in the middle class when they're given a list of labels. So you're given a bunch of possible labels and they're asked which of these is closest to who you feel you are. In most countries, including in South Africa, most black South Africans say they're middle class. And that's because they're defining their position relative to those below them and those above them. And most people have people below them and people above them in terms of whatever dimension of identity you're talking about. Very few people say, yes, I'm lower class. And very few wealthy people say, I'm upper class. They say, I'm upper middle class. You know, they sort of fudge it. They have this broad middle class, and they're in this sort of top privileged stratum within it. So I think in terms of identity, most people self-identify in that way.
Although you also have countries... Now, there are countries where many people, or even majority, would identify themselves as working class, and that would be a political statement.
Then it's a political statement. It's because there's a politically...
And then they're aware of the relations, and they are aware of some conflict that's there. And I know in the UK, a lot more people identify themselves as working class than in most other West European countries. And that's a long tradition of labor movements. And
Oksana, do you think intellectuals identify themselves as middle class? And we have first two questions later on.
That's actually a question for me, because I think they would like to identify themselves as a middle class, and they tend to think of themselves as a middle class. Maybe that could be identified by the way of their consumption. But in fact, if we see on their incomes, they are definitely lower class. Mostly, in most cases.
In here or in general?
Yeah, in Ukraine. No. Here in Ukraine. Okay, I can say only in Ukraine, because it differs from country to country, from culture to culture. And as for academics, as for journalism, as for
also for public sector workers, teachers, doctors, there's a lot of research on status incongruity or status inconsistency of how various aspects of the social status are, like, so that those jobs that are considered very important for society, like doctors, the medical profession, or teachers, but that are paid. Those are the lowest paid sectors of the economy in Ukraine. So the healthcare is the lowest, one of the lowest paid after agriculture, fishing, and so on. So that what you're talking about, this how people identify themselves, there's this status inconsistency there.
Okay, there were three questions. I know. Please raise hands if there are more. Gentlemen here, the lady over there, and you. And then I will take you and you as in the second round. Okay, so please. Introduce yourself and ask a question.
I'm Valentin Dyaktyar, student of sociology here in Cube Hill Academy, and I'm first year of magister's program. So, Mr. Wright, Russian academic Vladimir Inozemtsev suggests that class structure due to technological advance may shift to more emancipation in terms of relations at work. Like, for example, property of basic means of production for many workers is becoming personal, like programmers, coders can own their computers, and this is their means of production, and more people rely in their jobs on these technological means, and therefore, Inozemtsev suggests that deprivation just ends up naturally as phenomenon of mind. And what do you think of that? And is it likely that the structure of occupations may shift this way by technological advance towards more jobs with middle-class style relations?
So just to be sure I've got the question, you said deprivation becomes a matter of mind?
That is what Inozemtsev says.
Yeah, he's repeating the Fukuyama argument about technological advancement producing new higher class and new disparities within society based on the inner mind qualities that, the tech elite, so to say.
So what kind of psychological and proper qualities
you have? It's easier for me if I can answer, each rather than get an accumulation of questions. So I do think that the current, to use some old classic Marxian, Marxoid language, I do think the current development of the forces of production are posing an enormous challenge to existing relations of production. Intellectual property rights are very tough to monopolize, and they're constantly being subverted by clever geeks. What's called piracy is just the simplest form of it. It's very hard to have robust patents on ideas that are so easy to embed in alternative, in software and whatever. And we're also observing unpatented, uncopyrighted technologies out-competing effectively copyrighted and patented technologies. Linux hands down beats Microsoft in the competition over operating systems for computers. And the share of computers that have Linux systems on it as opposed to Microsoft is just steadily increasing. And it's an open source software package that's produced by unpaid labor of several thousand people globally who engage in this peer-to-peer collaborative process. So I do think that in all sorts of ways the new technologies are a challenge. Now what I would disagree with is that this implies increasing polarization in the society as opposed to possibilities for a radically more egalitarian structure. Because it doesn't imply, it also erodes the capacity for high-tech creative people to monopolize the means of creativity. A lot of these technologies can be deployed by people with just basic familiarity with computer programming. You don't have to be a high-tech, fancy schmancy computer programmer if you're using unpatented, uncopyrighted, open source materials, which then get organized in a way that anybody can, you know, with reasonable computer literacy, which will be very broadly disseminated, can use for whatever productive purposes. The idea of the creation of these things that are called fab labs, fabrication laboratories, big warehouse things with numerically controlled machines, in which you can get free software to use in the numerically controlled machines with free designs to produce products. And you rent the machines, and the machines can be owned by communities. They don't have to be owned by, you know, private vendors. And you can have little modular manufacturing that produces locally for local needs at very low cost. And the reason is that the economies of scale are also disappearing. So there's all sorts of new, fantastically fluid and unknowable alternatives that are being opened up, only one of which is increased polarization.
And provided there is enough education, as you said, internet or digital literacy in the society, which is a challenge sometimes, maybe not in American society.
It won't be a challenge anywhere.
Yeah.
It is now.
At some point, yeah.
But you know, if we're thinking short term, at what's going to be like in the next 5 years, or long term, what is it going to be like at 50 years from now? I mean, in the medium to long term, I think we have not a clue what possibilities for transforming social structures and systems of inequality are being opened up by these universalizable, free, open source technologies, which anybody can develop the skills to use pretty easily.
Mm-hmm. Let's try to collect more, but maybe if the questions are so rich, we'll answer one by one. So please introduce yourself. And
My name is Diana, and I'm studying in Mahidalic Academy. I'm a historian, historian of course. And so I have a question for Professor Wright. You said there was an example about students' demonstrations, and you said they are quite young and they have a lot of energy or something like this. And do you think that they can be the middle class? Or why the middle class don't protest? Or why the elder people, older people, don't protest? Don't they have a lot of energy? They like their position right now. And they don't want to protest because they feel that they can lose this in very moment when they go to the protest. That's it.
Well, older people do protest a lot as well. I mean, in the state of Wisconsin 2 years ago, there was the state capitol building was occupied for 2 weeks. This news might have reached here as well. There was this very big, 120,000 people protesting the policies of the state government in a city of 250,000 people. So people were coming from all over the region to involve in these protests. And there were plenty of retired people who were involved in these protests. It wasn't just the young. The main organizers and energy came from younger people. They were the ones who could stay up all night without falling to pieces. And they tended to have less responsibility, less burden. So there tended to be more people who were students protesting and who were retired, and fewer people with families and young children that kept them busy.
So do you think they demonstrate they are going to demonstration less than young people because they think they could lose everything that they have at the moment?
Well, certainly not in the United States. It's not out of fear that people don't go to protests. It may be out of apathy or laziness or other exhaustion or other commitments.
Thank
you. Yeah?
Федор Устинов, he's a philosopher,
and
Drobovich, pedagogical university. It's Western University.
Господин Райт, можно ли подытожить вашу позицию?
Can we say
утверждением, что средний класс не является, ну, категория среднего класса не является научным определением, что это скорее журналистское словосочетание.
Can you say that the concept of middle class is not a scientific concept, but it's just an ordinary language, journalistic word?
Поскольку он не имеет, ну, не занимает особого места в системе воспроизводства общества.
Because it doesn't have any special position in the system of reproduction of society.
И употребление его, независимо там, от отдельных желаний, в конечном счете служит цели разрывания понятия класса.
And when we use it, it means that we actually disperse the concept of class. So we make it, the concept of class is making less significant, less sad, more thin.
Well, I suggested that there are these two uses of the word, the scientific, sociological one, and ordinary language. But I don't think it follows from that there isn't value in the ordinary language use of the word, because it helps us understand something about the self-definition of people and the way in which cultural categories are being constructed in everyday life. And that is a scientific problem. How are identities and groupings culturally constructed? The fact that we have this very broad and commonly used expression that appears all over the world in different settings is itself something that's worthy of note and understanding what the parameters of that everyday discourse are. So, yes, I worry to some extent when I see sociologists forgetting the theoretical meaning of this word and therefore muddying the discussion by going back and forth without thinking about it. But I still think the ordinary language word has value. It does capture something about the world in which we live and therefore needs to be understood.
I understand the question. So the real question was about the political dimension of the use of the middle class. So when we talk about middle class, we actually do not talk about class and
capitalism.
Right.
We are not talking about capitalists and workers, we are talking about middle class, and middle class is a very broad category where there is no class struggle, no class antagonism, no contradicting class interests.
And you actually see, if I can also add, there was research by a Romanian sociologist, Mihai Varga, on sociology journals in Eastern Europe, and the amount, like the number of pages they dedicate to class analysis, and he showed There's very many papers, many articles in leading sociological journals in Ukraine, Romania, other places, on the middle class, but only like one, two articles per year on the working class and on class relations more generally. So talking about middle class also in sociology, for example, means very often not talking about class, but talking about identities, lifestyles, self-identifications,
with,
and so on.
So I agree with that with one big asterisk, you know, exception, which is increasingly the concept of the middle class is seen in antagonistic relationship to the top 1%, the oligarchs, the global capitalist class, the corporate class. That is, there is an antagonism in this discourse with the tiny elite that's causing trouble in the lives of everybody else. We are the 99% is a slogan that identifies the vast majority of the population against this destructive and antagonistic elite. And the idea that the middle class is under threat is not that it's under threat from, you know, the weather, it's under threat from that elite. And in that sense, I do think it, in popular discourse, there is increasingly a sense of the embattled middle class threatened by powerful actors, which is an antagonistic notion of class.
It's a form of populist. There is,
it's a populist discourse of antagonism rather than a, you know,
a scientific one.
Well, there is a one that tries to be scientific, at least. It's about precariat. I'm sure you've been following that discussion for the last years. That is antagonizing itself against the middle class. So in precariat, I guess, journalists and intellectual workers, especially young ones, with no secure job and no access to the welfare state assumptions, are juxtaposed against the people who define it against middle class. And these are, this is a rising debate. It was on the rise at least a year ago. I believe it's coming back. It's another example of a sort of a clash where middle class are the bad guys, or at least the guys that we want to clash against. But let me take two more questions I've seen on the from the floor. Yes, you, sir, and.
So my name is Michael Kompetenko. I'm a master of political science, not sociology. And in general, I would like to say that I came here to say that I do not believe in the existence of this category of classes, really. But I think there are social groups, but not classes, because middle classes may be some composition of many social groups, and it's not very formal, because some groups come to elite, some groups come to what we call working class or lower class, or how we shall call it in some another way. But my definite question is to Professor Rybchuk's statement about the questioner, where people were asked, do they want the representatives of the middle class and the working class, as you've mentioned, were asked about if they wished to have a job, state guaranteed job, well paid, or and the representatives of the middle class were for some reforms and so for the changes. So I would like to ask not you, but the audience. Do you wish to have a well-paid, state-guaranteed job? Or not do you wish? Who doesn't wish to have a state-paid, well-paid, state-guaranteed job? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Right. So we have. So my question is: do we have in this room only 5 representatives of the middle class? And are they our working class, or how shall we call it?
No.
I have to. Okay, take this question for a moment just to observe one thing. I also graduated from some interdepartmental studies in humanities, but mainly sociology, where I learned mostly that there are two differences between. There's one difference between economy and sociology. In economy, you in basically believe that the basic principle of economy is there is no free lunch. And in sociology, the basic principle is some do, some don't. I guess this question very much shows that. But maybe you have...
It's a common theme in the history of sociology to find people who argue that the concept of class is an empty concept, that there are no classes. Often that is combined with two additional claims. There are only people. You know, so economists like to think there are no classes because really it's just individuals with preferences acting in spaces of choice. Or there's a plethora of heterogeneous groups, and groups are whatever people say are groups. Groups are not a category independent of people's identities. So people constitute groups through the way, however it is, they classify the world. Groups are the self-identified classification systems of all actors. And occasionally they use class language, but mostly that's not the way people classify themselves and others. The alternative view is that these are objective structures, and it's a contingent matter the extent to which people's identities are formed by those structures. Classes are, in the first instance, a way of describing certain kinds of social relations that exist in a society that organize the way power is distributed over the... use and deployment of its resources. To say there are no classes then would be to say there's no power relations with respect to the deployment of resources. Now, I actually prefer a slightly different terminology. I don't exactly like the language that says how many classes are there. That's doesn't seem to me a useful way. I prefer to use class as an adjective than as a noun. So I talk about class structure, class locations, class identities, class struggle, class formation, that is the formation of collective actors, but not classes as a noun. I use it as an adjective. Class structures are really complicated. They're certainly not binary. They're filled with all sorts of class locations besides something that we could call, quote, the working class and the capitalist class. Lots of different locations within a class structure, which is something we could talk about, you know, later in this discussion.
Let me take the last question that I saw from a gentleman over there. Yes?
Recently, George Soros was told that it looks like for him that it has taken 20 years for his class to win the battle. I can't remember the actual his words, but it means that the war that lasted 20 years, it has been won by his class. So my question is, I'm just curious to know how you see as an American citizen, how you interpret his words.
It's a fantastic quote. I'd love to see where the quote came. You know, when he said that, it took us 20 years to win. It's an irony coming from him, since he is also very critical of his own class. You know, he would probably say it took us 20 years to win and I wish we would lose, because he's not a big fan of his own class position. I would make the following proposition. I think we are near the end of the neoliberal era. That we may be at what is the self-satisfied, smug sense of victory just before the collapse of that victory. I don't think neoliberalism is going to be the dominant way of organizing the relationship between state and economy, and therefore the dominant ideology for organizing class domination. I don't think it's going to be the dominant way of doing that 10 or 15 years from now. relatively medium term, I think there's going to be an unraveling. And there's already indicators of it. One indicator of the unraveling of neoliberalism is in the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy in New York. There is discussion. They brought over engineers from the Netherlands who are experts in seawalls to start designing the long-term project for building seawalls to prevent devastation of Manhattan in whatever cataclysmic hurricanes occur in the next decades. The cost of building seawalls to protect major cities is in the hundreds of billions of dollars, if not more, and can only be done through an activist state with taxing capacity to produce massively important new public goods. There's no other way it can happen. And it's utterly inconsistent with the neoliberal view of the market providing solutions to our major collective problems. The writing is on the wall. Neoliberalism can't survive the ecological conditions we will be facing, and the climate, especially around climate and its ramifications. Even if we don't worry about controlling emissions, if we're only concerned with adapting to the consequences of climate change, those have to be done through public goods. They can't be done just through private solutions. And the current state is disabled from doing that because of its erosion of its tax capacity. And the only way to reestablish its tax capacity is to impose constraints on capital. That is, there's going to have to be a state project of imposing constraints on financialization and globalization of finance. And that, I predict, is going to happen. It's going to happen because basically the options are catastrophic. The alternatives are catastrophic. It may depend upon catastrophes before it kicks in. It may be another Hurricane Sandy that actually inundates more than just the lower, the lower segment of Manhattan. Maybe it'll take more catastrophes. But I just don't think the 21st century story is going to be about the triumph and deepening of market fundamentalism as the way we organize our state economy affairs. Then the question for popular struggles and for the interests of ordinary people is whether that also provides an opening for a new round of democratic struggle for the control over the production of public goods, which is one way of talking about mitigating not just the ecological damage and harms of capitalism, but its social harms and damage through a democratization of the process by which the state-economy relationship is reforged. And I'm actually pretty optimistic about that. I mean, maybe not if I was a Ukrainian. I have yet to find an optimistic Ukrainian. There may be some, but so far I have only encountered pessimistic Ukrainians. But, maybe even here there'll be new sources of optimism as the developed world ceases to believe in this absurd understanding of how state economy and social relations should be built, namely the neoliberal fraud, in my view.
There used to be a saying, no taxation without representation, in the American Revolution. Perhaps the reverse is today an interesting idea to consider, no representation without taxation, which is the reverse of neoliberalism. Well, I'm very much in favor of discussion about that in the line of public good. But let us summarize with your closing remarks, Nastya, Oksana.
It's difficult to summarize like that. It's easier to answer questions if there are any more, maybe.
Yeah.
Last one.
All right.
Yeah, better to end.
Better to do that.
My name is Andrei Gudun. I'm a sociology student here at the Digital Academy. And speaking of class as a relation to means of production, we notice that some huge groups of people who are participating in class struggle aren't really related to means of production. One of them could be students who really protest a lot, as my colleague noticed. Where would you locate students in modern class structure?
Okay, good. That's one of my favorite questions. One always likes questions for which one has really, interesting answers, right? I mean, the heart of my work has been grappling with questions of that sort. So we can also ask it about children. We can ask it about retired people. We can ask it about
housewives.
There's all sorts of people who are not directly located within jobs in the conventional sense, that is, with respect to the power relations over the deployment of means of production. And yet, they do seem to be connected to the class structure somehow. What that means is there's different ways that people are, in fact, connected to class structures. One way is by occupying directly a position within those social relations. Another is through family, kinship, sometimes even friendship, sometimes communities. Just depends upon the nature of the social relations. But let's take family. So the children of parents who are in working class jobs are properly called working class children, not because they have a relationship to the means of production, but they have a relationship to people who have a relationship to the means of production. They have what I call mediated class locations rather than direct class locations. One of the interesting phenomena in a world where now most women who are married work is that you can have households in which the spouses are in different direct locations in the class structure. Some can be, you can have a working class person married to a manager, for example. I think managers as a distinct component of the middle class because of their location with respect to power. So you can have people having a different direct and mediated class location. And that's an interesting development. In some places in the world, these cross-class families, families that combine different relations, are the dominant form of family. In others, it turns out that people are married to people in the same kind of class location as themselves. I think of those as different class structures. That is, it's a different way of structuring the social relations that bind people to class relations. There's also a temporal dimension to class structures. People aren't just statically in a location. They have lives that spread out over time, which move them across locations within a class structure. Sometimes in a predictable, orderly way, we call those careers. Sometimes in a chaotic and unpredictable way, we call that flexibility, I guess, these days. There was a time when people's work lives were organized for a very significant part of the population as careers. And people moved through different kinds of class locations as a predictable aspect of what their work life was likely to be like. That means that their class location has a future-oriented component, a prospective component, not just a presentist one. We are now in a class structure where there's way less of that, where people's prospects for the future are very uncertain. Even for people who have pretty well-paying jobs, the prospects for the future are much less predictable than they used to be. And therefore, there's more temporal indeterminacy in people's class locations. People are less able to say, yes, in 10 years I'm going to be in X position. They say, I hope to be, I might be, but I'm not sure. And that's true even for people who have relatively, quote, privileged positions within the existing class relations. So these are all the kinds of complexities that make studying in a fine-grained way class structures a really interesting and challenging thing for sociologists. And which help to explain why there's so much uncertainty in how people identify their whole lives within class structures. There is a dissolution of class in that specific sense. That is a dissolution of the tight connection between biography and structure. That has changed. That's one of the phenomena of advanced capitalist and quasi-capitalist and would-be capitalist class structures. You can see I get excited about that. There was one other question, but
yes. Summarize an answer.
Okay.
Wonderful. I think we can then thank you for participating. Thank you for wonderful questions and a discussion. What else to say? I think the Polish Institute might have some other announcements.
I'm very grateful that you decided to talk together, and it was really interesting. I hope that it might be just the beginning of the future reflection about classes or other kind of organization of society right now. And I hope that you will all visit our websites, Krytyka, Respublika Nowa, Spilne, and I don't know if you are connected with any journal or...
Amazon.com, type in on Eric Olin.
Eric actually has all of his work on his webpage.
Oh, great. Oh,
Against copyright.
Yeah, you can, nearly all of my books you can download free if you want to. Just go to my website.
And as our colleague said, wonderful, tomorrow there will be a lesson. Just
a lecture.
Yeah. I'm giving...
At 6 o'clock here in the same same venue.
And in...
It's going to be on gender and class. So continuation.
Gender and... On the problem of how do we understand the connection between gender and class and their transformation. But I also want to just, in a sense, advertise. I'm coming back in June for a week. This is a two-week event of my visit. And in June, I'm going to be talking about the material that I really care about, you know, where my current research is located and thinking. It's the idea of real utopias. And as a way of thinking about the transformation of the world in which we live, real utopias, rather than just plain ordinary utopias, or just pragmatic reform, real utopia as a way of thinking about transformation. So if you want to hear about that, keep an eye out for a problem. I imagine something will happen in this room, possibly, back in June.
There's a very interesting Ukrainian artist from Kharkov who deals with the utopia. He built one of the most interesting projects last year called Don Rosa, about Donetsk as a state of utopia. So I hope that we will have a chance to present some works of him. So thank you one more for your participation.
No, it was wonderful.